Hot Links, Gandhi, Dangerous Liaisons, Groundhog Day, My Name is Joe, The Fisher King, and You've Got Mail. The answer is composer George Fenton, who scored all of these films, as well as 100-odd more. He also provided the music for several big-budget BBC wildlife documentaries, including Blue Planet. So we are indeed in esteemed company on our latest episode of Soundtracking, the weekly podcast about screen music with me, Edith Bowman. I caught up with George on the release of Red Joan, a British spy drama starring Sophie Cookson and Judi Dench. As usual, you'll hear George's work from this and other movies throughout the conversation, as well as his experiences of collaborating with Stephen Frears, Ken Loach, Nora Ephron and Sir Richard Attenborough. And it's with a beautiful cue from Sir Richard's film Cry Freedom that we begin, called Dangerous Country. George, welcome to Soundtrack, and thank you so much for your time.
Well, it's lovely to be here.
Absolutely mesmerising diving into some research about you and just seeing the wealth of music that you've created for film over the years. Congratulations. Wow.
Thank you.
It's amazing.
It's been great, actually, and a long haul, but a good one. It's always been interesting because the people... I think, you know, film's so collaborative, and if you are lucky enough to work with really great people, then you get involved in some great projects. And I've just been very fortunate that way, that I've met and worked with through mainly luck, just had the opportunities that I've had. So yeah. It's been good.
Let's talk about the most recent project that I've been lucky enough to see, Red Joan, directed by Trevor Nunn, and this wonderful, I guess, opportunity for you as a creating music for it around these two different time periods as well. We were kind of joking earlier about, are there still stories to be told about the Cold War and about spies? And this is great because it's a female perspective and these two points in the life of this woman, the older version played by Judi Dench and the younger version played brilliantly by Sophie, whose surname I've completely forgotten for Sophie Cookson. At what point were you brought in on this project?
Well, I mean, unusually for this in my career, I actually put myself forward for this because I had I read it and I thought it was such an interesting story that I kind of volunteered, which I don't normally do, only because to volunteer and then be rejected is oh so sad.
Yeah.
But I sort of volunteered to do it, and then I didn't really get involved. You know, it's a sort of normal process. So I would come in once they'd shot, got a rough cut, had a sort of couple of looks at it, sort of somewhere between an assembly and a fine cut. They would start, and I'd start to look at it.
Thank you.
And the time jumps are very interesting. But I think that the key to the film and, you know, what we call the spotting of the music, mm-hmm. right, where to start and stop, which drove the score in a way, because the most important aspect of this story is that whenever you're watching Sophie Cookson as the young Joan,
yeah,
you need to be aware of the older Joan, mm-hmm. that it's her story that's being told.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's not about two stories. Mm-hmm. It's not about this was this young person and then this is this old person. This is the story of the young person through the eyes and through the memory and
yeah.
the eyes of the older person, prompted by the people that are interviewing her.
Yeah.
So she's all ever present, I think. And she's a very big personality, Judy Dench.
Yeah.
So actually she is ever present. I think you don't ever sort of totally, you never sort of lose her in the story, hopefully. And she inhabits the old story.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about what it is that you connect with then when you're watching those, the kind of rough assembly or whatever it is. Is it a combination of things? Is it the emotion you're tapping into? Is it the performances as well? Do they play a part in influencing where you go musically, be that with melody or be that with instrumentation?
Well, it's hard to be analytical because I'm nearly always, touch wood, working. So I'm working now, and I don't want to try and explain what I'm doing, how I think about it. But I think it's a mixture of things. It's to do with looking at the film and seeing really what is on the screen, what needs to be touched in. You know,
yeah.
So if you does the scene play with enough tension,
mm-hmm.
without anything, or not? And if it doesn't, then that's one thing
yeah.
music can do.
It's really sprinkle your magic.
Yes, you can do. Well, music can do something, you know, in that direction. And I think then, other than that, yes, the emotional connection with characters. And the emotional connection with characters is something that is a privilege, really, when you write film music, because you have the film long enough. You know, we go and see a movie and we just say, oh, I liked, you know,
yeah.
I like The Green Book, or, you know, I like Black Klansman. Or
yeah.
You know, we just say, yeah, we liked it. But what did we do? We only went, we just had a look at it, came home, that was it.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're writing for a film, you're with it every single day.
Yeah.
Non-stop, every shot, everything. You know it backwards. I can recite the film, and I can recite the scene order, and because I'm so into the every nuance of every mm-hmm. cut and everything, it's a treat in that way. You know, I've never sort of
yeah.
thought of it before like that, but it is actually a real privilege to be allowed to know something that well because of the skills involved. You know, the skills in every way: the camera, the cutting, production design, the
yeah.
acting, the directing. It's all they're all evident to you when you're working on it.
You have the time to actually kind of pay attention
yeah.
to them specifically.
Which
yeah.
I do love. And the only difficult thing about it is that, you know, when you commit to writing music, music's quite labour intensive
mm-hmm.
and you have to work quite hard to write it.
Yeah.
So when you get into it, it just becomes, you suddenly reach a point when it tips over and it becomes how to write this piece of music.
Yeah.
And then to stand away from it and be objective about what it does and how it works, that's when it gets
yeah.
tough.
Yeah.
But doesn't matter, because there's always people waiting in the wings
to tell you.
To come and tell you that
yeah.
they don't like it.
Yeah.
So actually, it's okay, yeah.
But it's wonderful to see the relationships you have built along the way that continue and working with directors, you know, on several occasions. And you mentioned Stephen Frears in the number of films that you work with on him. Immediately, I think of Dangerous Liaisons. Wow.
I know, it's a wonderful film.
Oh.
Thank you.
Everything about that, though, you talk about, you know, you have that luxury of watching things over and over, and you appreciate the costume designer's work and the makeup and hair. And with that, that's a great example of all these pieces of puzzle just fitting perfectly.
Jim Acheson, the master, the costume, I mean, absolutely astonishing.
Yeah.
And Philippe Rousselot, the camera.
You've got a great memory.
No, well, I mean, they're very, very great people. But I mean, since you mentioned it, and as I was saying before, that the film is full of most wonderful performances. But Glenn Close in that film is almost unbelievable in how great she is.
How did she not get the Oscar?
Because you know when you're working and you stop the film, you know, you stop the film, and usually it's a really bad shot, you know, it's a really bad moment. They've got
their
mouth sort of hanging open with the tongue hanging out. So it's just like you stop the film and it's like, well, honestly, you could go frame by frame through that film and there's never a moment when she doesn't completely know and her eyes don't completely tell you what's going on. It's just incredible. The power, I mean, the power. And, you know, we see these people on screen and you think, wow, you know. Mm-hmm. But you forget that they've had to get them out their trailer and then they have to stand around and then they have to take the coat off because they're freezing cold, and
it's got this contraption of a thing on.
Yeah, then they give them take your cup of coffee. Okay, well, you're ready. Yeah, and then we're not quite ready yet. And then okay, we're ready. Yes, okay, turnover, sound, dink. You know, and then bang, clapperboard, and then
they need to be in it.
Yes,
like
and,
that.
And that is a skill you can never overestimate. Great acting is like up there with everything, I think.
Did you go on set at all for that?
I did.
Did you? Yeah,
I did. In Paris, I went on set because I was supposed to play the conductor, or well, the Kapellmeister, as it were, of the orchestra in the opera in the pit.
Yeah.
But the shots of the orchestra in the pit in the opera were cut, actually. So I didn't appear.
Awkward.
Although I have since appeared as a conductor in a film. That was a shame.
What do you remember about working on that film and what are your memories of?
Well, what was really great about that film was that I had an early meeting with Stephen, and I thought that we were going to use, because we'd recorded the opera, which was, you know, Gluck, French opera. And so I thought we'd probably use, you know, music that was contemporary to the period. Mm-hmm. So we would use some, I don't know, Vivaldi or, you know, more Gluck, whatever. And I had a meeting with him. I went around to his house and I said, are we going to go this way? And we played a few examples of period music. And he said, I don't know, actually. He said, I think it probably should be more like North by Northwest.
Interesting.
That's what he said. And I said, okay, yeah. Because the way I've shot it and everything, and then of course, because he's a great scholar of film, the framing of like all the close-ups, I'm not sure if they are exact copies, but he used as a reference, one of the references he used was the film Notorious, and it has, so when we then tried, you know, then I said, okay, well, so we played a bit of Bernard Herrmann's music just against the film.
Mm.
And it just sort of went, oh, hello, you know. So I then thought, well, this is great because it means that the music can be part of the, or can be a malevolent character in this film.
Yeah.
And I can make this music like a malevolent force. Scenes in it where he's messing around, John Malkovich, and the music is sort of in that sort of noirish,
yeah,
dark Bernard Herrmann way, kind of saying, and now he is being terrible to this person.
Yeah.
And he is. And then it would kind of break down into a bit of Vivaldi sometimes as a sort of a joke. So he gave me an amazing opportunity with the film, and I love doing it. I really, really did love doing it.
There's a wonderful list of films that I kind of made some notes on. For me personally, that just resonated. We'll get on to Ken Loach in a minute because you've worked on so many of Ken's,
yes,
wonderful, wonderful films. But I wanted to mention The Fisher King with Terry Gillingham, if that's,
oh, right,
possible, please, because I love that film so much.
It's a lovely film.
It's incredible. There are so many great films out there that you're reminded about by various things happening, and with the really sad passing of Robin Williams. And that was the first thing I went to because I think it's one of his best performances, and it's, Terry gave him the opportunity, I think, to give a performance that no one else had really given him that stage to do.
Again, you know, the old adage, script and cast, you know.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful script, brilliantly cast, because the foil that Jeff Bridges was to Robin.
To Robin, yeah.
It was just great.
That's such an important thing, isn't it? The chemistry.
Absolutely,
the casting's important, but that chemistry has got to...
That you've got to have that kind of chemistry going on. Of course, Terry is such a kind of wild man.
Yeah.
Know, and crazy.
He's like a mad wizard.
Yes, he is. And he will... When you're writing, again, you know, if you're writing a thing and you go and see the film and then you... He does where the camera near the front of the film, do you remember, where it tips,
yeah,
over the side of the building and,
yeah,
looks down the building? And you go, I love this.
Mm-hmm.
He's just opened the paint box and he's
You're just in there already.
He's just going to play now. Mm-hmm. And he could. And I think that there was something in that in Terry that completely chimed with an actual side of Robin's personality.
Yeah.
And in a way, when you look back on it, it's very touching and sweet.
Feels really true to him.
And really true to him.
Yeah.
You know, there is a certain kind of wackiness that is absolutely in his DNA. And I think the story just tapped into those things. And again, it was so fun to do. And I absolutely loved it. Done one other film for Terry since called Zero Theorem, and that was
which I love the main theme for that as well.
I loved the Zero Theorem,
amazing,
and it was just as crazy, you know, and everything. But it's not. There was something about the Fisher King. I think that it's quite important that the Fisher King was one of the films, perhaps one of the few films where Terry's been working within a major studio.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in The Fisher King was very well looked after, absorbed, you know, that they could absorb the kind of, I can't think of the words, I don't want to say lunacy, but you know, they could...
Creative lunacy, the
sparks flying.
Yeah.
And it was very well produced. So there was a kind of a framework around it and production values given to it that meant that he could really, really deliver.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that Terry needs is he needs a blank check.
He needs creative freedom.
Yeah, because if he has the blank check, he can do extraordinary things. Mm. And he can do extraordinary things without it. But somehow, you know, that was a really good feeling, that film. Mm. It didn't have any... There seemed to be no problems. That's really nice.
How did you get to meet and start working with Ken Loach?
I think it was largely because, I mean, I've never asked him who it was that suggested he called me.
But he hasn't called anyone else since.
No, he hasn't, no. But I think he'd done several films. I mean, of course, his background is that he did a lot of films without any music at all.
Yeah.
But he had a period of working with Stuart Copeland. And
yep, from
they
the Police,
did great. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
the drummer from Police. And they did really good. You know, I loved the films that he made, mm-hmm. Riff Raff and those things yep. that they did. And I think that Stuart used to live in London, and then I think he moved back to live in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I think they tried to do one film, and he was over there, Ken was over mm-hmm. here, just like.
It's not the way he wants to work. Yeah.
Maybe not. And. Now it sounds funny because you would say, well, it doesn't really matter where he is because we can Skype or we can do, you know.
Yeah, but back
but
then yeah.
And Ken also likes sort of to be, you know, to work in a certain way. So he just literally rang up. And when he rang up, I thought it, first of all, must be a joke because at that time I was mainly doing rom-coms. And
you got Mail and things like that?
Yes, no, things for Nora Ephron and Groundhog Day and things. You know, I didn't...
Which I watched again recently. My husband and I sat down and watched it. It was one of those things where we were going, should we watch a movie? Yeah. And we went, and it was like, yes! Let's. Oh my God, it was such a treat.
It's
what a
so
treat.
Good.
Oh, it's such a great film.
It's brilliant. It is a great film, yeah. I saw it recently too, actually, and I haven't seen it since it opened.
Treat it was.
Well, I mean, he was. He was another person that was just. I mean, he got unwell and died.
Yeah,
too
Harold
young.
Ramis,
but,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I'd been doing all those kind of films, and I was. So I thought there was a mistake, you know, or something, and I went along to meet him, and he just said, "Well, we're doing this film," and I said, "Okay." It was called Lady Bird, Lady Bird. Mm. Had a most amazing performance by Chrissy Rock. And I did the score, and that was that. And then we've kept going.
Yeah.
I think we've done 17 now.
Wow. I've made some notes on some of my favourite ones.
Go on.
But please feel free to tell
me
some of yours.
No, I don't mind.
My Name is Joe.
Wonderful film.
Oh,
yeah.
My Peter Mullen, oh, I could. Amazing. I mean, one of my favourite actors, full stop. I think he's just incredible.
Oh, come on, Shanks. Jesus, I have to go through with this, right? So what happens in the future? Does he hold up Liam again and say, I'm going to kick his fucking head in unless you do another job?
I do these two jobs and I walk away.
Do these two jobs? I thought we were just going for a wee trip up north. Where'd the second job come from?
It's just two jobs.
Fuck's sake. You may as well get your fucking membership card for the McGowan clan.
Oh, fuck off.
Oh, come on. Way.
I'm not working for him. I'm doing two jobs for Liam.
Is that it? Do you get short-term contracts for fucking drug dealers? What's the problem with Liam's family? What is the fucking problem with Liam's family? What's the problem with Sabine Jo? Tell me.
She's a junkie.
Oh, well, you might as well go up north and get her some fucking junk then, eh? You dance with a fucking devil, that's it, man. You're in the fucking gang.
You are, Joe.
I can't believe how fucking naive you get to talk.
I'm not being naive. I'm not going to call my tune. You've got to trust me, man.
And there's some really fun bits. There's obviously a bit of status quo in there as well.
Yeah.
But there's some beautiful themes that you've created. Sarah's theme is beautiful, beautiful piece of music as well. And that thing where that music can do so brilliantly and so subtly, where it can tell you so much about a character that words can't.
That's a very nice thing to say. I think it can do that, provided the shot's there.
Yeah.
And the performance is in the shot.
Yeah, there's a marriage of that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, if you can respond, but you said a very nice thing, and I think what you've also said is a very pure thing, and that Ken doesn't like the artifice of music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't like, as it were, in inverted commas, film music.
Yeah.
But what he doesn't dislike is if the music can find a way to play a straight truth. And if it plays a straight truth and means that you can experience the character themselves or their background or their feelings or something in a more focused way, then it's good. And I think that, weirdly, although he's so economical about music, that in many ways that his outlook about music in films actually speaks in the best and most precise way about what film music should do at the end of the day. You know what I mean? It distills it down to something that's almost impossible sometimes.
Yeah.
You know? But it does actually say what his point is.
Yeah. Out of the films that you've worked together on, what's your most... I was going to say memorable, but I don't know if that's the right...
Oh, it's easy.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Looking for Eric, because I'm a Man U fan.
Me too! Me too!
There you go.
My dad took me to Old Trafford when I was 14, and that's it. That's it.
So, you know, it was the biggest kick
Yeah, I bet.
Was to do that.
You were on set every day.
I wasn't actually. I did meet Big Eric, and it was great. Yeah, I loved it.
What was it like working with them, Richard Attenborough? What was he like as a director?
He was a wonderful director. He was also probably one of the best producers of all time because he had a wonderful way with people.
Yeah.
It's harder for me to talk about him in a way now because when I met him, I was very young and he was sort of like a father figure to me. So I can't really speak about him in a way that sounds sentimental because he'd looked after me to such a degree and gave me so many moments where writing film scores, particularly for things like Gandhi, which the studio are advertising as a world event, has its pressures, you know.
Yeah.
The object of this massive tribute died as he had always lived, a private man without wealth, without property, without official title or office. Mahatma Gandhi was not the commander of armies nor a ruler of vast lands. He could not boast any scientific achievement or artistic gift. Yet men, governments, dignitaries from all over the world have joined hands today to pay homage to this little brown man in the loincloth who led his country to freedom. In the words of General George C. Marshall, the American Secretary of State, Mahatma Gandhi has become the spokesman for the conscience of all mankind. He was a man who made humility and simple truth more powerful than empires. And Albert Einstein added, generations to come will scarce believe that such a one as this, ever in flesh and blood, walked upon this earth.
And the situation was quite tricky because of the interested parties, the Indian government and Ravi Shankar, who I was working with, who, you know, wanted things one way and blah, blah, blah. And it was all kind of quite intense.
Mm.
And he had a way of just making you just okay.
Yeah.
He just would look after you and he would say things that, you know, one of your great nightmares when you're writing a film score always is this score going to be dropped and am I going to get fired, you know? Because is it any, I mean, what will happen? Because
it happens.
It does. And it obviously happens because it's the last thing in.
Yeah.
So it's going to be the first thing out. You know, you can't go and reshoot the film.
Yeah.
You can't go and get another person to play the main part.
Mm.
The one thing that everyone can sort of say, oh, I think we really could do better than that, is with the music because it's coming at the last minute.
Yeah.
And I didn't know, kind of with Gandhi particularly, I mean, I wasn't really sure why I was there. I mean, it was because I was so inexperienced. He would just make it okay. He would just say, well, if it can go right, you'll just have to do it again. he was really wonderful to me, and and I owe him in a way my career, because his the first two films I did for him, Gandhi and Cry for Freedom, sort of in a way put me on the map.
It's interesting you say that, because I spoke to Barry Jenkins recently about If Beale Street Could Talk. He's a wonderful, wonderful man, and you know, he was saying that it was really interesting because he knows that Nicholas Britell, who he works with, very much reacts to the performances. And if he'd cast someone else as the mother in If Beale Street Could Talk, the score would be completely different.
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting thing to think
I'm
about.
I'm sure.
In terms of those performances, and you know, talking about some of those films, Fisher King, if it hadn't been Jeff Bridges and Robin Williams, then your score would be very, very different.
Yeah. In a way, that's why film is so endlessly fascinating to work in.
Mm.
Is because you know that the slightest thing can change.
Mm-hmm.
I did a film for Nora, which shall remain nameless.
And?
Well, we did a film, and it had a stellar cast, you know, fantastic cast. And people literally were falling about at the rushes, you know. It was hilarious and dark and funny and everything, and witty and this, that, and the other. I mean,
I think I can guess the film.
What's coming. It's just like, what happened? No one knows. It just, they stuck it all together and it just didn't work. Mm. It just wasn't any good. And you can't describe how easy, you know, it is.
To get it wrong.
To get it wrong.
Yeah.
It can only be one thing. And Ken, who I admire for so many reasons, but one of the things that I admire him for and envy him for, and everybody does, is the fact that he makes his films in a way that he can listen to his own voice and it doesn't get distracted by other interested parties. He doesn't allow it to be distracted for that reason.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean he won't listen to what people say or doesn't want to know what people think, but he doesn't have to experience that kind of mayhem that can sometimes happen when everybody's trying to help fix something that they can't, you know, you know, blah, blah, blah.
And too many cooks.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, we would never stop. We're under.
And on that note.
we'll move on. Yeah.
Before we run out of time, I wanted to also just talk about the wonderful sounds that you created and music you created for, and continue to do so as well, for things like Planet Earth and Blue Planet and Frozen Planet. And are those things fun to do? Because
they were fantastic to do. Yeah. Yeah, the Blue Planet, in a way, changed everything for me because I could see that I would go on doing film, you know, film after film after film. When the Blue Planet came along, it just was a whole different thing, and the fact that I was able to write a big orchestral score for something like that, and that's what they wanted, and then everything that flowed from it, because you know, I had the most amazing opportunities because the film of it I recorded with the Berlin Philharmonic, and it was just amazing. And then I made concert versions of all these things and take them out and play them in the Hollywood Bowl and things. And, you know, it's amazing the sort of magic of the Blue Planet. And now the Blue Planet has Blue Planet 2 and presumably Blue Planet 3 and 4 and 5 and forever onwards, and Planet Earth the same. wrote so much music for those things. Yeah. I mean, hours of music.
Yeah.
That I don't in any way wish that I was still doing them. They were a sort of a wonderful period in my life, but I like to keep moving.
Well, it's like you were saying earlier about not doing the same thing over and over and over again. Have you got like a, not a wish list, but have you got things or directors that you, you know, you talk about Red Joan and you were like, I want to do that, and kind of putting yourself forward for it.
Yes, and there are, I did another film called Cold Pursuit.
Yeah.
Which was distracted largely by Liam Neeson's press conference. But in actual fact, I really, really enjoyed that because it was sort of out in a bag that I've never worked in before.
Yeah.
And with somebody who I thought was a fantastic director, Hans Petter Møllen. And I did the score all electronically and with old analog gear. And I really loved him doing that. And I worked with my nephew, Dan Carey, who's a...
Oh, amazing. I know Dan.
You know Dan?
Yeah.
He and I did it at his studio.
Oh, wow.
So that was really nice.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Is kind of finding ways to step into new territory and new areas.
I think so.
Yeah.
Just lately, since you mentioned Danger Keys, there's a theatre, an opera company in Germany who are currently performing a ballet called Dangerous Liaisons, which has music by Handel, Vivaldi, Corelli, etc. But it does have also some of the score.
That's brilliant. Have you seen it yet?
No, I haven't seen it. But it is really nice that they're doing it. And that is, in fact, one of the things that I still wish, I hope I can do one day, is do something for dance. That would be...
Brilliant.
I'd really love to do that. But in the film world, I mean, yeah, whatever. I think working in sort of different... with different people who make things in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
That's why working for Ken was such an amazing thing when it happened, you know, because he makes his films in a completely different way than every other film I'd ever done.
Yeah.
So it was great, yeah.
Was composing for film and for TV as well something that you always wanted to do?
Not really. Yeah. No, not really. I don't think so, no.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, because I'm older now, when I grew up, it was a very unusual world from someone with my background to go off and become a composer of music for films, because there were very few opportunities and there were very few pathways into doing that. And I mean, I had a wonderful childhood actually, but there was something in my childhood always that made me feel I didn't quite fit with my life, the expectations of what my life would be. You know, I always felt just like I was sort of outside it somehow. And music was the thing that I got solace from or a kind of a kick from, you know, playing in bands and things when I was a teenager, where I just could lose myself for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. And so I knew that I wanted to be in that world. But if someone had said, hey, you know, there's a job going at this recording studio and I'd become an assistant engineer and then an engineer, or I'd become a record producer, or I played an orchestral instrument and I could have become a musician. Mm-hmm. And I think I would have been, any of those things would have been fine. I just wanted to be in
that world.
In that world, yeah, because of the people.
Yeah. So how did you make that first step into composing?
I was playing for a living, and I had played... this is not a tip of how to get into the business, by the way, because this is so ridiculous, what I'm about to say. But anyway, I was playing... I'd done a job playing in the theatre for the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Yeah.
And I got a call from the Royal Shakespeare Company saying that a director there would like to meet me. And I assumed that the director in question wanted me to play. In fact, the director, because I had... When I first started in the business, I'd had a job in a West End play. I'd had an equity ticket, and I also had my picture in Spotlight. He had seen my picture in Spotlight and confused me with another, with an actor that he'd seen on the TV or the assistant. So actually, he wanted to meet someone else.
Oh, wow.
And he thought that I was that person. That you were that actor. I was an actor. So I went with my guitar to the audition. And he said, well, and we sort of said, you know, and he said, well, you're here, you know, why don't you, you may as well play us something since you're here. So I played him something. And he said, well, he said, you could be in the show, actually, you could be. And you could be in the court of Orsino and you could be in the play. And I said, oh, okay, fine. And he said, and I, to play a bit of, you know, lute or whatever, yeah. You know. And then he said, do you think you'd be able to arrange some of the music, some of the songs? And I said, yeah, probably. And he sent me off to see, to look for the songs. And I went and looked for them, the traditional arrangements, you know, or traditional settings of the Shakespeare songs. And there was one that I couldn't find. So I wrote something. And then I played it when I was playing all the other ones. I said, I've got this. I don't know what you think of this. I didn't say I've written it. I just said, and I played it to him. And he said, yeah, that's good. And I said, okay, good. I said, I wrote that one, actually. He said, well, that's good. Well, you could write the rest then.
That's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. I did. I wrote the music to it. And like I was saying at the beginning, you know, the business of writing... in this way, so much depends on the people you work for. And he then opened as a theatre, Riverside Studios in Hammersmith.
Oh, wow.
So I did all his plays there. He made a TV film of a Stephen Polyakov script, and I did that. The producer of that asked me to do the next one, which was being directed by Stephen Frears.
Amazing.
Etc. Etc. And so people, you know, would see his work, and then you know, and the rest. That's how it.
The rest is history.
Well, that's it. Was how I got going. I mean,
that's amazing.
The weird thing, it's become harder and harder.
Really?
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I think because you know more, so you become, you know, the more you know, the more insecure you get about what you don't know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think when you're young, you just go, oh well,
okay.
I'll do this, and what do you think of that? Yeah, great, okay, fine. you don't think, yeah, but is it too, or is it this, or is it?
Don't analyse things as much. Think about them too much. Thank you so much for your time. Absolute pleasure.
It's been bliss. Thank you so
much. I've got to come back for part two at some point because there's about another 70 odd films to talk.
It's because I talk too much.
No, not at all. George, thank you so much. Cheers.
You.
As mentioned earlier, that's the main theme to Terry Gilliam's The Zero Theorem, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with composer George Fenton. My huge thanks to George for taking the time to talk to us, and to Venetia in his office for helping us out with some of the harder to source cues. His body of work is truly staggering and well worth checking out. We've put a Spotify playlist up for this show, which you'll be able to access via edithbowman.com, which is also the place to catch up with all of our previous episodes. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK, and do keep telling your friends about us if you like what you hear. Next up, talking about their latest tiny little film, Avengers Endgame. It's a return for the Russo brothers. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.